Okay, I was just informed that we need to vacate this room at 5 o'clock today. There's another function in here. So I was hoping to stay till 7 or 8, but so I'm going to be pushing every presenter and every chair along, and I'm going to limit comment to 2 and 2 if I need to. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that in mind, I'm going to move as quickly through this as I can, but the council does have to be brought up to date on a couple of developments. So, we'll go as fast as we can, but there is some complexity to this. The Habitat Committee stuff is behind tab 7. The committee met November 14th. The PDT has met several times between the two committee meetings of October 2nd and November 14th. The Phase 2 development has been an evolutionary process, different than really than any of the other FMPs that we've developed. And it's been kind of maddening in a way, because it's required constant adjustments of timelines as we have fit things in as we go along and made this evolution occur. But we've now reached a point where we're on a firmer track and have a firm timeline. The only thing at this right now that could possibly screw that up is our dual role. As Chad pointed out to me when I first became chairman of this committee, the most important role to date of the Habitat Committee has been its consultative role. And that consultative role, unfortunately, with the way energy development is going and the political realities of that, may wind up taking up time in that we really don't have. So we have to relieve this kind of long-term threat the threat to maintaining our long-term scheduling. And I'm thinking particularly of projects like Cape Wind, and now we have a new one in Rhode Island that's suddenly reared up as a threat, and I think we're going to get a whole lot more. Rhode Island had as its goal the use of wind and tidal power sufficient to make up 15% of the entire power requirements of the state within 10 years. This was designed to be all within state waters as a state initiative, and the commercial fishermen of Rhode Island, in what I think is a very wise move, got on board right away. Rather than being part of the problem, became part of the solution. And they formed liaisons with both the state and with the companies that have been selected to do some of this work in order to be in on the ground floor and protect their interest, because these were, of course, in Rhode Island, all of state water is good fish habitat, important fish habitat, and they wanted to be in on the ground floor, and they were taken in right away and became consultants, and were forming they're actually becoming part of the company that was going to set this up. But then along came the executive order that we saw recently that gave states the ability to move out to 50 miles on energy development, and all of a sudden the issue became much more clouded. In a move that the commercial fishermen at least thought was something of a stab in the back, Rhode Island announced that they were going to now start planning siting out to 20 miles, and we're specifically looking at a site 20 miles southeast of Point Judith. That put it basically on top of Cox Ledge. All of that area out there is essential fish habitat anyway. And it seemed to be a way of it looked like they were going to be kind of trying to slide the fishermen out of there. So this became an issue at our last Habitat meeting that we discussed at some length. And we decided that since this new proposal, this special area management plan in Rhode Island, now included federal waters, and since we were not put on the list of organizations that were to be consulted, that we needed to really let these people know that fish were there, that there was a fishery there, that it was essential fish habitat, and get on the ground floor. The danger here being that if we wait for the normal consultative role, that we'll wind up with a lot of these from everywhere from the Canadian border down to New York, and they're springing up like mushrooms without any set way of having to do it on an ad hoc basis, the consultative role on an ad hoc basis. And that could become very onerous for the Habitat Committee and for the Council at a time when we're trying to do other things. So it's it was a sense of the committee that we need to move into this at an earlier stage. And we discussed how to do that, and we decided that we needed to have some sort of a policy that included a letter that would go out at the beginning when these things first cropped up, as soon as we heard of them, a letter to inform the people involved of what their requirements were under the Magnuson Act for consultation. And we talked about perhaps initiating a policy, and Lou told us that ASMSC is almost already working on that, and the Mid-Atlantic Council are already working on that. So rather than reinventing the wheel, we decided that we needed to contact them. But at the beginning, we need to begin to initiate action on this. So I'd like to put up the first motion, which is intended to do that. Motion. Okay, the first motion, the committee motion, is that the council craft a template letter to project proponents and regulating agencies detailing the potential aspects of offshore energy generating facilities / projects that may have an adverse impact on essential fish habitat, fishing grounds, and fishermen.
Committee motion doesn't require a second. Dave, is this similar to the letter that we've written before, like on Cape Wind and other projects?
Yeah, it is. It is similar, but the thing we want to do is to have some sort of a template so that we don't have to go through tasking Chad or whoever is in that job every single time one of these comes up. The ad hoc nature of this is going to be a problem for us as we start getting wind proposals on, you know, all the islands of the main coast and a tidal proposal for Rhode Island, and it's going to become a problem. So we want to, instead of sending a letter at the time the EIS is developed, we think we need to inform these people, because a lot of them don't seem to know it, that we need to be in on the ground floor, and rather than always being reactive, we want to be proactive on this and inform them right up front what the fisheries implications are. That's the intent of this.
Paul Howard.
No, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there should be a lot of debate on these. There's always a scoping document. We always comment on scoping, and I think the service has a staff dedicated to looking at proposals like this that we work with all the time. So this should be a pretty quick no-brainer to move forward.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Okay, Dave.
Okay, good. I'm glad we got that out of the way. And it's also the intent that we contact ASMSC and the Mid-Atlantic Council. And I see preparing this letter sometime before the February Council meeting, but Chad won't have much time, so it'll be after the Phase 2 stuff is submitted to the SSC. Okay, the Phase 2, I'd like to just quickly go through what our approach is, and then Chad's got an explanatory presentation on it. The approach we took is that in Phase 2, when we're trying to determine what kind of council actions or management actions we need to put in place in the habitat area, that what we need is some kind of an objective rating of area and gear, because a subjective just saying, well, this is good, this is bad, this should be protected, this shouldn't be, that isn't going to get it. We have to have a much more objective way of doing it, and that's where this came from. And we also have to bear in mind that as we move to an output-based catch share management system, that regulatory closures are probably going to become inappropriate, and we're probably going to wind up with closures that are primarily habitat-based. So in order to maintain fairness among the user groups and to achieve economic efficiency, then what we need to do is to have a really objective way of looking at threats to the habitat. And at the beginning, we looked at the possibility of a formal risk analysis. Formal risk analysis, it was decided, was essentially too static and not appropriate to what we needed to do. So what we chose was a vulnerability assessment. We looked at what other councils have done and arrived at the choice of a qualitative matrix-based analysis. And that's it's unique to New England, but the method is not unique. The method is used in fisheries all over the world, in fact. The matrix is now, we've got the structure of the matrix in place. It isn't fully populated as to the data points. That's ongoing as we speak. But we're now at the point where we're looking at an SSC review of the matrix. And we'll get into that. We've got the terms of reference ready later on. But with that in mind, I'd like to turn it over to Chad and have him explain how it works. Chad?
Okay, Chad. 56 slides, 28 minutes.
Nothing to it. As Mr. Preble alluded to, the council's objectives for phase two were to identify all the major fishing threats to essential fish habitat of those species managed by the council, to identify and implement mechanisms to protect, conserve, and enhance the EFH. For those species, define measurable threshold. Those first two, incidentally, come straight from the Magnuson Act, from the EFH provisions. Define measurable thresholds for achieving the requirements to minimize adverse impacts to the extent practicable. That's the council's decision. There are, in the Magnuson Act and in the EFH final rule in the guidelines, there's no definition of a threshold for an adverse impact. An adverse impact is an impact on EFH that's more than minimal and not temporary in nature, but that's obviously subject to policy calls on the part of the council. And so one of the council's objectives for phase two was to try to come up with some measurable thresholds for defining that. And then to integrate and optimize measures to minimize the adverse impacts to EFH across all the council-managed FMPs, as David said. So with that background in mind, we'll talk a little bit about how the PDT and the committee have been developing the phase two analysis. The analysis or the product that we're going to try to come up with here is a first step. It's intended to assist the council and the committee and the public in understanding the issues that would help them make decisions for alternatives for minimizing the adverse impacts of fishing on EFH to the extent practicable. So it's not it's kind of one step before what the PDTs and the committees typically deal with, which is an impacts analysis. So my objective today is to describe the components of the matrix and mapping tools that are being developed by the PDT to assist the committee and the council in developing and analyzing alternatives for minimizing the adverse effects from fishing on essential fish habitat to the extent practicable. So there's four components to my presentation today. We're going to talk about the literature review that underlies the assessment that we're working on. I'll talk about the vulnerability assessment itself, the modeling and mapping that goes and is subsequent to the assessment, and then end products that the council can expect to see at the end of this whole thing. So we'll start with the literature review. This is the foundation of everything that we're doing, basically. It has to be ideally, it will all be documented in the literature. It's a comprehensive evaluation of the applicable published studies. It includes peer-reviewed journals, gray literature, agency studies, prior management documents from both New England and other councils, anything we can find that's relevant to the task. So the strategy here is to create a comprehensive database of reference material that would include all the studies that we've used in the past, 2003 for Amendment 13 and Amendment 10, scallops and groundfish, did a very comprehensive review of the literature on the effects of fishing on essential fish habitat or habitats in general. And so we want to incorporate all of those literature reviews and all of those studies, and then also obviously all of the studies that have been conducted subsequently. And we've got the PDTs come up with a little access database that would allow for kind of databasing each of these studies. So right now, there's 402 published studies that are in the database, and some of the initial coding, 228, were related to gears that are applicable to northeast fisheries, and then 128 of those are related to both gears and habitats found in the northeast. So the database will contain metadata specific to each study, summarizing both the contents and the results of the study, but also the data quality, and that is, I'll talk about data quality for a second. We've got three different ways of thinking about it that are illegible to me right now, so I'm going to turn to the right page here. There we go. So we've got a subjective appropriateness, which talks about whether or not the study is kind of directly supportive of the vulnerability assessment that we're working on, or whether it's only kind of tangentially related. If it's unrelated, obviously it wouldn't be included. We've got a study design metric that talks about whether the study is a comparative study or an experimental study, and then a relevance, whether it, how a way to rank how relevant it is to our task. And then there's the coding of the contents and results. And this is just an example that's on the screen or on the paper, but basically we're going to be coding each of the papers, each of the studies, with all of the different components of the vulnerability assessment. And so that will allow us to link some of our conclusions in the matrices that I'm going to show you as the presentation goes on back to the actual studies that provided the data that underlies that. So the advantages are it allows for the coding of the individual studies using categories and effects that are being utilized in the matrices, and it kind of hard codes these individual studies to the results and allows people to track the decision making that went into the end products. And it creates a legacy product for future PDTs and the committees and the council to build upon. This is something that you can integrate future studies into. They might alter the conclusions or might support the conclusions. And then the disadvantage is that it, you know, requires a fair amount of labor. Since when has that ever stopped us? And so for future work, it's just going to be, for this particular aspect of the project, it's just coding all of these studies with all of the different categories that need to be filled out. The database has been constructed. Most of the categories are relatively firm from the PET, although we're constantly in flux. And so we're basically beginning work on this and hope to have it done. I said at the committee meeting last Friday that we hope to have it done by Christmas or New Year's at the latest. With the chair's permission, or does the chair have a preference on taking questions at the end versus in the middle?
End, please. The end.
The end. Moving on to the vulnerability assessment. The goal of the assessment is to categorize or quantify the vulnerability of habitats to fishing gears, and the method is this literature-based matrix assessment, and the outcome will be a comprehensive evaluation of the sensitivity of northeast gears to the effects of fishing, northeast habitats, excuse me, to the effects of fishing from northeast gears. So a vulnerability assessment is the process of identifying, quantifying, and prioritizing vulnerabilities in a system. For our purposes, a particular piece of habitat is vulnerable when it's sensitive to and capable of experiencing a gear impact. So vulnerability is a function of sensitivity of a habitat to a fishing gear and the ability of that gear to impact the habitat. So for the matrix, which is not necessarily spatially based, we're assuming that all of the combinations of habitats can be impacted by all of the combinations of fishing gears. That is, we were not looking at having blanked or redacted cell values simply because we don't believe that the gear can impact that type of habitat. In this case, the vulnerability would equal sensitivity. Sensitivity is a combination of the effects of a fishing gear on the functional value provided by a unit of habitat and the susceptibility, what we're calling susceptibility, and the recovery in functional value that a unit of habitat will experience after the gear has passed, and that's the recovery. So sensitivity here is a function of susceptibility and recovery, where susceptibility and recovery vary across the different types of habitats that they're going to encounter, which are conditioned on the energy environments, that is a high energy versus low energy environment, and then the types of fishing gears that impact those habitats. critical components or habitats, energy environments, and fishing gears. Obviously, these things tend to be continuous in nature, but we're going to have to define them categorically for the matrix. So that's what we went about doing. We'll start with habitats. Fish habitats are continuous and constantly changing, and for the assessment, they'll be distilled into hierarchical classes consistent with the literature and hopefully useful. These classes will form the impact surfaces for the assessments, what we're calling our assessment endpoints. The top tier of the classifications are these four things, and this is kind of the end product of the vulnerability assessment will be measured individually on these four items: geological habitat components, biological habitat components, prey species, and deep sea corals. So we'll start with I'll start explaining the geological habitat components. They're classified in two sub-tiers, class and substrate, and then we're defining substrate in terms of dominance. Basically, we understand, I think everybody understands, that if you were to take a look at a piece of the bottom anywhere in the northeast region, you're likely to find multiple types of substrate, be it, you know, an undercoating of cobble or pavement, and then sand that either recedes or covers based on energy environments or storms or things like that. And so we are striving to find a way to classify a unit of area by its substrate, and so we're choosing dominance, which is defined by area or frequency of occurrence in replicate samples or volume, depending on the sampling design and device. We've got a couple of different data sets that we're using to define spatially where the different habitats exist, but we're thinking about it in terms of a dominated environment, that is a cobble-dominated or a boulder-dominated or a sand-dominated environment. So here's how it looks kind of in a table where you've got classes being gravel, sands, and muds, and then individual substrates at the mud silt level, sand, granule pebble, cobble, and boulder, and these are defined in terms of millimeters on the Wentworth scale. And the class is necessary there because for a good portion of our data, which is the US seabed data, they don't go above the they don't disaggregate above the sand level. That is above 2 millimeters. If it's 2.2 millimeters or 265 millimeters, it's all considered the same thing. And that forms probably about 40% or 60% of our data inputs for the spatial model. So we wanted to have that class variable there so that we don't try to create something that doesn't exist. That is, we don't try to say something is dominated by boulder when, in fact, the sampling device was only capable of detecting a granule. Now we're going to switch to the biological habitat components, and we've got four sub-tiers there. We've got a type, which would be epifauna or infauna, an orientation, emergent, encrusting, burrowing. Burrowing applying to infauna, and encrusting applying to epifauna. Character, whether it's hard or soft, and strategy, whether it's R-selected or K-selected, that refers to its kind of life history strategy, where R-selected species are have highly quickly recurring populations and can have expanding populations because of a high turnover rate, and K-selected species have stable populations and kind of a low turnover rate. So the matrix, the row headings for the matrix would look like this, basically. So for each combination of infauna and epifauna, you'd have emergent and encrusting or emergent and burrowing with hard, soft, R-selected and K-selected. The prey species and deep-sea corals, I'm not presenting the matrices for these yet. The prey species, actually, the PDT's probably spent more time on than anything else. And for better or for worse, we're just not prepared to present it yet because we're not really sure how it's going to look. We've made some changes to the matrices over the last month and a half, and we're still trying to integrate those into the prey species matrix. Deep sea corals will probably look very, very similar to the biological habitat components. In fact, you could think of them as being essentially, they're going to be emergent epifauna with a hard character, and they're K-selected. So it's actually pretty straightforward. As for energy environments, energy environments, or environments with different energy characteristics, are created by the flow of water over habitats, and these affect the nature of the fishing gear impact, the loss of functional value that that unit of habitat provides, the susceptibility of those habitats to fishing gears, and the recovery rates. So it conditions all of the aspects of the of our conception of the matrix here. It alters the gear effects across all combinations of geological, biological habitat components. And they're going to be evaluated under, we're going to determine whether a piece of habitat is a high energy or low energy environment based on a critical shear stress model that takes surface flow and uses some assumptions about how that flow translates down to the bottom, and so calculates basically a critical shear stress value for every unit of habitat that's defined spatially in the Northeast. If that is above a particular threshold, or if the depth is below a particular threshold, that piece of real estate would be coded as a high-energy environment, whereas if the critical shear stress value is below the particular threshold, it would be categorized as a low-energy. We've got the depth component in there because the critical shear stress model that we're using has no way of calculating the impact of wave action on the bottom. And in many, if not most, if not all environments, the wave action is much greater than the flow, either the daily or the biweekly or even sometimes the storm event flow. And so that we're using depth as a proxy there because we have no model for calculating the wave action impact on the bottom. So gear effects are a function of the type of the gear type of gear used, the quality or degree of contact that the gear has with a given habitat, and the functional value provided by that habitat. And this is what we're going to talk about next. Gear types, as we did in Amendment 13 and Amendment 10, which was the last time we did a major update to the adverse impacts of fishing on essential fish habitat, we describe all of the gear types used throughout the Northeast region and then focus on the most important gear types. In Amendment 13 and Amendment 10, we focused primarily on otter trawls, scallop dredges, and surf clam ocean quahog dredges. And we're expanding our matrix-based assessment to include 10 gear categories now. Within the otter trawl kind of super category, we've got shrimp, groundfish, and scallop trawls, monkfish trawls, squid trawls, raised foot rope trawls, and pelagic trawls. Within the dredge gear, we've got New Bedford-style scallop and surf clam ocean quahog dredges. Trap gear, we've got lobster and deep-sea red crab, and then long line and gill neck gears. So my point here is that while all of the other gear types will be described in the document, the actual impacts of those gears will not be quantified in the matrix. Only those 10 gears that I just put up would be quantified in the matrix. Gear impacts will have effects that vary with the habitat components they encounter, and we kind of aggregated these into 9 categories: crushing, slicing, plowing, scraping, creasing, burying, compressing, breaking, fluidizing, slicing, dicing. The gear effect classes, these impacts result in effects that vary across the habitat components. That is, you've got a slicing effect that has a particular impact on either a geological habitat component or a biological habitat component or prey species. And these effects, we need to classify to incorporate them into the matrix. So we've got, for today's presentation, we've got 4 effect classes being considered for each combination of gear and habitat component and energy environment. And these are the 4 for the geological components: resuspension, homogenization, redistribution, and destructuring. And for the biological, we've got exposure, burial, detachment, and removal. And then the description of what those mean. So to assess sensitivity for every combination of gear type, habitat component, energy environment, the PDT will assess susceptibility and recovery individually or separately. And these are going to be based on these 4 gear effects that are unique to each habitat component. So these are example metrics of what susceptibility and recovery might look like. They'd be evaluated on a scale of 0 to 3 and have a definition that would go along with each one of them. I'm not going to read all of these definitions. You can kind of, maybe you can make them out in the 4 slide handouts. I'm happy to discuss with you. These were pulled from some work that was done out on the Pacific coast, and they're not finalized from the Habitat PDT's perspective yet. So this is what the master matrix would look like for geological habitat components, where you've got dominated environment. I'm going to have to go to my picture because I can't quite read it on the screen. But you've got a dominated environment with granule sands and muds. We're going to specify the type, the particular impact types that are specific to the gear type that's being used. So you can see on the top line there, it's the gear type. So we would have this matrix times 10 for the 10 different gear types that we've defined. And then we'd look at the impacts at the substrate level, mud, silt, sand, granule pebble, cobble boulder, high energy and low energy environments. And then the S and the R are the susceptibility and recovery. Evaluate on a scale of 0 to 3. For the biological habitat component, it's a little bit bigger, harder to read, but we've got epifauna and infauna, high energy and low energy, emergent encrusting or emergent and burrowing, hard or soft, and R-selected versus K-selected. And again, there's gear at the very top, so this matrix would be multiplied by the 10 different gear types. And there's actually some discussion at the PDT level right now whether or not we need to disaggregate by the underlying substrates. So there's the potential to have this multiplied not by 10 gear types, but by 10 gear types and 5 different substrates, which obviously greatly expands the workload. So now I'm going to talk about how we can put all of this into some maps and models that might make sense for the committee and the council to make decisions on adverse effects minimization strategies. We're using what we're calling a swept area seabed impact model to provide a measure of the area of seabed contacted by a fishing gear in one unit of effort, whether that's a tow or a net or a trap or a series of traps, as scaled by the sensitivity of that habitat to that gear. The model places emphasis on how the gear is used, and we're trying to come up with a structure that would reward gears that are modified to reduce seabed contact, such as those designed to skim over the seabed or with ground gear raised from the seabed. So we've got models constructed for, and again, these are all preliminary and subject to change right up until the point that they're going to be reviewed by the SSC, but we've got a trawl gear model that takes the distance towed in one tow as input value, so it's the distance towed in one tow, the effective width of an otter board, a contact index, a sensitivity index, the effective width of the ground cables, the effective width of the sweep with corresponding contact indexes, and basically tries to, it's under the assumption that each of the components of the gear acts on and behaves relative to the habitat in a different way. The doors impact the habitats differently than the sweep and differently than the cables. And so we're trying to quantify the severity of those impacts differently. Done the same thing with scallop dredges. We toyed with two different models for scallop dredges, one that incorporates shoes versus cutting bar, et cetera, in the chain bag. But right now we're leaning more towards a simplified version that just has the distance towed, the effective width of the widest dredge components, and a contact and sensitivity indice that would correspond to that. So this would not disaggregate the impacts across the different components of scallop dredge. We've got a model, a corresponding SASE model for demersal longline and gillnet gear and for lobster traps. And again, these are all still in development, but I wanted to kind of set them out there so people can read them and try to start to understand what they mean. So some of the assumptions that underlie the models are that fishing gear impacts are constant within a tow or within a unit of effort. There's a constant impact along the entire length of the gear component, and the impact of each gear component is cumulative. Gear component has the same impact on the epibenthos and infauna, irrespective of its size, length, weight, design, et cetera, et cetera. Seabed topography and composition are consistent within the tow. This is a kind of a necessary evil of kind of categorizing units of habitat. The abundance of epibenthos and infauna within a tow is uniform. Again, same thing. Otter board angle of attack is constant for, this is for trawl gears. Ground cables are straight along their entire length. Seabed contact does not change within the tow. That's an assumption that goes across all of the different gear types. And that the effective towing speed on the seabed contact is accommodated by the distance towed. And we're not trying to kind of capture the float of the gear or anything that might change relative to speed. So for parameterizing the model, you'd have to come up with data for each of the components. So we can empirically derive from observer data and other sources the contact patch, that is the size of the trap or the length of the toes or the length of the ground cables and the sweep and the size of the otter boards. The contact index is going to be categorically specified by gear type, and that's going to be a decision that's made at the PDT level, and it's going to be based primarily on kind of professional judgment. And the sensitivity index is calculated from the vulnerability assessment matrices. That is, the sensitivity index is going to be some function of the susceptibility and recovery values that are applied at each cell, each row level in the matrices that I showed earlier. The model represents essentially, you should think about it as representing a quality-adjusted area of seabed impacted by the gears within a particular spatial unit. Historically, we've used 10-minute squares. We could go to a 5-kilometer grid. We haven't decided exactly what the spatial unit is, but we'll get essentially a meter-squared value, a summed meter-squared value for all of the different gear types that through data are shown to have fished in that area. And that won't necessarily represent, won't at all represent the actual amount of contact. It'll represent the quality adjusted amount of contact. That is, you'll get higher meter squared values for components of the gear or gear types that have a more sensitive impact, or the habitat's more sensitive to those gears, and lower meter squared values for gears that have a lower kind of contact index and sensitivity index. The sensitivity index derived from the vulnerability assessment matrices are going to be specific to a combination of gear type, habitat, and energy, but they're going to apply uniformly across all the gear components. That is, we have struggled with and so far are unable to apply an individual sensitivity index to, for example, the otter boards, the cables, and the sweep. So we're going to apply, as of right now, we're going to apply a uniform sensitivity index across all three components. So for the data that would go into a spatial representation of all of this, you would need the impacting actions in an impacted surface. And the actions that are impacting are fishing effort and energy, which is a function of depth and flow, that critical shear stress model that I talked about earlier. And then the impacted surface are the substrates, the biota, prey, and the deep sea corals are four assessment endpoints. So this is kind of a little picture of how it would work for the geological and biological habitat components, where you've got depth and flow and geology, and then the sensitivity of the gear, and then you'd sum across all of the different gear types in each unit of area, for each chunk of real estate that you're talking about. Same thing with the biological, where you've got the strategy, the R-selected, K-selected, the character, hard, soft, the orientation, whether it's emergent or encrusting, etc., and then the energy and the type in fauna or epifauna. And then those values then get carried across each gear type and summed within each unit of real estate. And we're experimenting with different spatial units, with different real estate units. Right now we're looking at something called Voronoi tessellations, which are kind of an inconsistent grid that varies in proportion to the density of the available data. So you get irregular-shaped polygons. And here is an example. This is the polygons of a Voronoi tessellation based on all of the geological component inputs, all of the data we have on what the substrates are throughout the Northeast region. These are based on SMAS data, US seabed data, trawl survey data. So each one of those, it's really hard to see at this level, obviously, but what you can tell is that there are areas that have very dense data, the darker areas, and there are areas that have very little data on what the substrates might be. And you would produce a similar map on what the benthos might look like, and you'd see the same thing. You've got particular areas that have a lot of data and other areas that have very little data. If we were to go from the outset at, say, the 10-minute square level, you would miss all of the heterogeneity of the underlying data, and you would probably end up with some conclusions that are based on, without understanding that some areas we know a lot, in some areas we know very little. And so the PDT is trying to be very careful to capture that as best we can. Right now, on this map, you've got 42,378 different area units, or pieces of real estate that you would look at calculating values for. It's clearly way too many to deal with. About 30,000 of these are smaller than 3 kilometers squared. Now, we had an interesting discussion at the committee meeting. I found it interesting anyway, where at the beginning a lot of the kind of criticisms, criticism might be the wrong word, but questions about the vulnerability assessment dealt with the fact that we're not capturing enough of the heterogeneity, enough of the variability of the data. And if you think about 3 kilometers squared, well, that's just too big. You know, you've got rock piles here and sand there. But if you think about it in terms of the fishing effort, 3 kilometers squared is actually pretty small. You know, you assume 2.8 knots for a tow, and they're going to tow for 3 hours. They cover a lot more real estate than that. And if you were to try to put the fishing effort into a 3 kilometer square, how would you do it? Would it be the beginning of the tow, the end of the tow? Would you have to try to figure out exactly how the tow occurred within that unit? So we're looking at setting a minimum size that might be, presumably would be larger than 3 kilometers squared to reduce the number of units that we're going to need to assign data to, and hopefully increase the usability of this assessment for the PDT for the committee and for the council. This is the depiction of the area of each polygon, where you get the bluer shades show smaller areas and the redder shades show bigger areas. It's really just a colored version of the first picture I'd put up. Here's the substrate dominant classes, where the red are boulder or cobble, and the green are mud and silt, with the yellows and light greens as sands. And again, you're going to, obviously, these are coded by the shape of these polygons, so that's a lot of what your eye is going to be drawn to. So that's the model and the spatial component, the mapping component. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the end products that the committee and the council can expect to see from this. Expect to see matrices summarizing hypothetical sensitivity of habitat components to fishing gears. It's hypothetical, and again, because we're assuming that in the matrix, all of the gear types are available to impact all of the habitat surfaces. You'll get maps depicting the realized vulnerability of habitat area units to fishing gears as measured by that quality-adjusted meter squared that's the result of the SASE model, and summed across all of the gears fishing in each unit of real estate. You can do this in a couple of different ways. You can look at the realized based on actual fishing effort, or you could apply some assumed fishing efforts across the entire map and get sensitivity, a picture of the sensitivity of the habitats that doesn't necessarily follow, for example, the footprint of the fishery. You could look at the sensitivity of habitats inside and outside of closed areas right now without having to necessarily just look at the footprint of the fishery. Also, the committee and the council would probably want to know how things have changed over time with regard to minimizing the adverse effects of fishing, or adverse effects of fishing might have changed over time. So you'd be able to look at, for example, however far back we can go in the effort data, how things have changed on an annual basis. Understanding, of course, that the underlying habitat maps, the geological habitats, the prey habitats, the biological habitats would be static. We're not going to be able to show that a unit of fishing effort has resulted in a change in the geology or the biology of a unit of habitat, simply because of the types of data that we have to work with. And then we'll have an assessment of adverse effects that are going to be based on some predetermined thresholds that the committee and the council are going to need to weigh in on. You'll have to see some of the results of our matrices and SASE models before the PDT would be able to provide the committee and the council with recommendations for thresholds of defining adverse effects, those effects that are more than minimal and not temporary in nature. For developing alternatives to minimize the adverse effects of fishing on habitats to the extent practicable, the maps and matrices will provide the public, the committee, and the council with an objective tool for assessing the level and spatial extent of adverse effects. And again, we hope to be able to display the spatial extent of these effects, whether or not they're adverse, of these effects, both with and without using the existing footprints of the various fisheries. And this should allow the committee to focus on the appropriate areas for management. Customarily, we talk about the three major tools that decision makers have to minimize the adverse effects being area closures, effort reductions and gear modifications. And then alternative impacts analysis, the matrices in the SASE model will allow the PDT to quantify and visualize the changes in the quality-adjusted seabed impacts, which would enable analysis of area-based fishing restrictions, the mapping of hypothetical or redirected fishing effort, and gear modifications by changing the SASE context and sensitivity indices to show that potential cumulative impacts of gear changes might be. And so for future EIS impacts for across all of the different FMPs, this approach would create an objective kind of iterative model with a consistent set of metrics for analyzing and comparing adverse impacts. So you'd be able to look at adverse impacts at an FMP-specific level, and then as FMPs develop new amendments and framework documents, we'd have a consistent set of metrics for evaluating adverse impacts. This is not something the council has had previously. 20 minutes? I didn't have my watch on.
27 minutes and 36 seconds.
You're kidding.
I am kidding. Questions for Chad? Dave Preble.
Yeah, I just wanted to just kind of quickly sum up the intent here. The if we're going to manage habitat changes, we have to have some objective measure, and that's what the attempt is here. What we want to avoid is a situation where we have one group of people coming in and saying, well, fishing doesn't affect the habitat or it improves the habitat or whatever, and another group coming in and saying that fishing is like clear-cutting a forest. Both are clearly wrong. So we have to have some way of determining just what fishing really does do. And I'd like people not to be afraid of this and think that this is going to be some tool to close up the ocean. It's also a tool to open it up. And I want you to bear that in mind as well, because what this will show is that perhaps some of the areas that we've closed don't need to be closed, and that's clearly a part of this. It's not going to be just a way of adding restrictions onto the fishing industry. Management actions will still be based on the judgment of the council. What this is a tool to improve that judgment. That's the way I look at this. I don't look at it as any kind of threat to anybody. And I want that to be very clear that that's where we are with this. We have to remember there's an impact on the habitat by fishing. Some of it may be negative, some may be neutral, some may actually be good. We haven't been able to incorporate that yet. But there's also an impact on fishing by management, and we have to make sure that impact, whatever it is appropriate and not done with too heavy a hand. We have to remember also that that this system that Chad and the PDT have developed is self-correcting. Since it's based on data, as the data improves, each point in this matrix is based upon clear, identifiable data that's been peer-reviewed. As new data comes in, this can be refined on a real-time basis. And I'm sure we will find that, I hope we find that to be true. It's the intent that this be a self-correcting process as it goes along, not one that just gets written into policy and then and never is revisited. So it's got to be self-correcting. It has to lead to management actions that are fair, and we have to remember that sometimes opening an area is just as important as closing it, and it's not focused on that at all. So it's with that spirit in mind that we did this. The ultimate decision on management action is still the council's. It doesn't necessarily mean closure. It may mean helping people design gear that has less of an impact or a negative impact, or fish at times with less of a negative impact. These are all intents of this matrix. It's a tool to help with our judgment, not to replace it.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I thank David for his clarification. That was very helpful. With regard to your presentation, Chad, thank you very much. I realize this is a formidable effort. You with the plan development team, the Habitat Committee, have put a lot of time into this, and we certainly appreciate it. We also all realize that models can be muddles, and it'll be your job, the job of the plan development team in particular, to help us avoid the models and convince us that the models, avoid the models, and then help convince us that, you know, what you're giving us, what we will be using will actually be analyses based on, you know, robust and reliable models that really do have some applicability. I was very glad to see some of your slides that looked familiar to me. I think they were slides or plots of data types that were provided by SMAS researchers. Students contributed to that. Of course, the researchers, the professors at SMAS. Superb work done at SMAS. I'm very, very glad that they're involved in this because some of their work, if not all of their work, related to habitat classification will be extremely useful for us. So my question is, in one of the documents that we have in our binder, I think it's number 2, there's a table number 1 that shows grain size thresholds for the 5 sediment categories used in the vulnerability assessment. Boulder, cobble, pebble, granule, sand, and silt clay. Is that the classification of sediment types that has been used by SMAS, or is this something different?
Well, the Wentworth scale is a scale that has been used by many, many people, but it goes back to the 1960s or maybe even earlier, 1940s for USGS. There's a couple of different scales for categorizing, and they're all basically, if you're going to use a millimeter-based, you know, a grain size-based categorization for substrate, this is pretty consistent with all of the different approaches that have been used throughout the literature.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'm very pleased to see in this category, we're going to need this as council members, we're going to need this information, pebble granule areas as opposed to just gravel as a category. I think in the past we've been somewhat misled, not intentionally, regarding habitat types. I don't like referencing an area as gravel when it may be predominantly pebble and granule. Very small. Now, perhaps with further discussion, the PDT will break that down further, pebble granule into some different categories, maybe use a different scale, I'm not sure, but I hope that there's further debate about that. But at a minimum, I'm glad to see it's pebble and granule because we can make a real serious distinction between those areas that are of that type and that those that would be of the larger size, for example, cobble and larger. My other comment, in the first part of your presentation, you referenced the literature database, and I hope that that database will make a distinction between trawling, studies that involve trawling, beam trawling versus auto trawling. There's a lot of literature out there that gets confused because there are discussions about trawling impacts when it's actually beam trawling impacts as opposed to auto trawl impacts. So that's just a word of caution that when you go into that database and when we use that database, that distinction must be made because there's a dramatic difference in terms of impact on habitat from beam trawling and auto trawling. And of course, beam trawling is done primarily in Europe. Many studies have been done in Europe, so that European work is not necessarily applicable to the U.S. in auto trawling. And then finally, in document number three, towards the end, next to last page, you show your sensitivity index, and this is going to be a very important index, clearly, for you to use and for us to apply. And I need a clarification. In the last bullet on that next-to-last page, where you show the sensitivity index, the mathematical equation for it, you come to the last bullet, and there is the listing of category, mud, sand, gravel, cobble, and boulder. I need to make sure that I understand what you're referencing here relative to gravel. Was that a misprint? Is that supposed to be pebble and granule as opposed to gravel? Because again, I'm really sensitive to that word. So if it's granule and pebble, make sure it's listed that way.
It is a misprint.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And with that said, one other thing. I'm also very glad to see that there's a distinction made between that you include a category of burrowing. Because in many of the discussions that I have had with those concerned about the impact of bottom trawling on the seabed, there has been a focus on auto trawling in areas where there are certain sea anemones. They're burrowing sea anemones that will come out and be erect, and they look like a forest. When you see them undisturbed, but when they are disturbed, they will retract down into their burrow. Hence, they're a forest that is not clear-cut, potentially. They're down in their burrow. So I'm glad to see that characterization in there, and I suspect that will lead to some more thought about the impact of bottom trawling in areas where there is mud, because when there are areas with mud, we'll find certain species of sea anemones that are burrowing sea anemones, and we all need to have more discussion about the impact of trawling in those areas, because if those sea anemones retract and they're in their burrow, when they sense the approach of a trawl or a scallop dredge, that has great implications for our eventual determination as to what area should be off limits or what area should have certain restrictions related to bottom trawling and other forms of bottom gear such as scallop dredging. So good work, and I'm encouraged to see how much progress has been made by the Plan Development Team and the Habitat Committee.
I shouldn't do this. I have to, because otherwise there's going to be a misperception. On the anemone thing, anemones will probably be categorized as epifauna, in which case they will not have a burrowing category. Burrowing would only apply to infauna. Unless, I'll bring the issue to the PDT, and we'll see if we can find a way to categorize, but we can only work with the data that's in the literature and the data that's in the data sets. We'll do our best. To the extent that we fail to capture your concerns, we'll highlight it. And obviously, the ultimate utilization of these tools is going to be up to the policymakers, and we'll just do our best to be as transparent as possible on that.
Dr. Pierce.
I appreciate this, but I appreciate that point, but this is a real serious issue, and it will have tremendous implications for our decisions down the road about bottom mobile gear fishing on the bottom in the mud. If it's considered to be epifauna, that has, as opposed to a marine life that is burrowing, that has implications. So I've raised it as an issue. You're sensitive to it, and as long as you and the PDT are sensitive to it, I guess I should be satisfied with that. Thank you.
And I'm sure, Dr. Pierce, you'll continue to check in and see where the development is on that issue. Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. Just to clarify that a little bit more, the sea anemone issue was brought up specifically as you described it, and it will be clarified. We'll make sure of that.
Anything else for Chad? Any other questions? Okay. Dave, you have another motion?
Yes, I do. On the timeline, it's very important for this to keep its timeline in order, because as we're coming up against the need to have this this entire amendment done and in place in order to serve the nearest target is to serve the scallop amendment. So what we need to do is to get this to the SSC for a March evaluation, which means that all of the stuff has to be in by February, and it has to be developed to the point where we can make four demonstration runs is what the committee decided on. So what we did was we came up with a set of terms of reference for the SSC review. Do you have those available, Chad, ready to go with it?
They're in the binder, Dave.
Yeah, okay. I know they are. I just wanted to see if
document Chad number five.
Yeah, I've got them right in front of me. Yeah. Okay, well, let's refer to that then. It's page 3 on document number 5. I just wondered if Chad had one to put up on the board. The terms of reference include the literature review, and the questions are there, the vulnerability assessment, the spatial model, and the original TORs were deemed to be too general, so that what this represents is what we finally came up with for our TORs. So the committee motion is that the Habitat Committee recommends the Council adopt the amendment terms of reference for the SSC review of the Omnibus Phase 2 analysis.
It's a committee motion, carried 600. Paul Howard.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't this be superseded by our vote that that primarily the Executive Committee should now look at these and task the SSC? based on our discussions, because
based on a discussion,
you know, we can't have the council spend hours and hours deciding what the SSC does. We had that debate yesterday. So what should happen is that this will now be brought to the executive committee for their review and then submitted to the SSC.
Right. Okay. Well, why don't we just withdraw the motion then, because in light of the new policy, the motion has been superseded by the new policy, so we can just go ahead and withdraw it.
All right. We'll make sure that the suggested TOR changes do come before the executive committee, though.
Yeah, okay. Then that's
input
what I'll do.
From the Habitat Committee.
Does that need to be a motion?
No.
Okay, then it's the sense of the committee that we should put these TORs before the executive committee for transmittal to the SSC.
Without objection? Okay.
Okay, then I guess that's it.
Anything else, Chad? Dr. Fogarty, you ready? We're going to try to make up some time. Okay, thank you.